start my internship on the Gene Stead, but instead stayed at Emory. And then in 1950, I got snatched into the Navy for active duty during the Korean War. And when I got out, everybody that I had known at Emory had gone with
Stead.
Dr. Beeson, either Dr. Stead, half of them came here, and the other half went with Dr. Beeson, who was his replacement, to Yale. And so when I got out of the Navy, there was nobody left in Atlanta, so I came here and joined my former mentor in Atlanta, who by that time had come here with Gene Stead. So I came here too to finish up my residency and a fellowship. And
what was your residency and fellowship in?
Cardiology. And so I became a cardiologist at the VA hospital in Durham. Well, at first I finished about 6 months of my residency that I needed for my boards, and then stayed on as a cardiologist at the VA, and then joined the faculty at Duke in 1953, in mid-year, about July, and I became a faculty member in July of 43, in June of 43, and I've been here, I've been around ever since.
Out of curiosity, did you deploy to Korea, or were you stateside?
Stateside. I had 1 year at Bethesda, at the Naval Hospital there, and then 1 year teaching electrocardiographic techniques to flight surgeons at the Naval Air Station at Pensacola. So 1 year in Bethesda and 1 year in Pensacola. Not bad.
I could see the country.
And then I came back. That's when I came to Duke.
When was the idea of a PA first floated around, or when did you first hear about it?
It evolved in Gene Stead's head, but it evolved for a reason. The person who followed me in cardiology at the VA was a man named Henry McIntosh. Henry McIntosh went on to head the new catheter lab, cardiac catheterization lab at Duke. And the cath lab operated with nurses as assistants. And they literally, this was the beginning, I guess, of the national nursing shortage. And they could not find nurses to become assistants in the cardiac cath room. And Henry McIntosh was really desperate, and he talked to Gene Stead, his chief, about how to get around the situation, and Gene Stead was an innovator of that all. And he said, well, you know, does it have to be a nurse? No, it doesn't have to be. It has to be somebody who's intelligent and who's responsible and who is willing to learn. So who might fill those shoes that meets those criteria? And Henry began to think about ways of doing it, and he thought about firemen. Firemen have jobs that occupy them for 3 days a week, roughly, and then they're off for 3 or 4 days, and many of them take other jobs. So Henry said, well, let's see if there are firemen who want to moonlight. And so he found 3 or 4 firemen who wanted to do that, and they thought that they could recruit 3 or 4 or 5, and out of that they could get enough to meet their manpower needs. This worked, and they found firemen to be satisfactory assistants. Then somebody suggested that there were Navy corpsmen who were assisting in a new laboratory that was at the Naval Hospital in Norfolk. And so Henry had the bright idea of, well, instead of getting people like firemen who then have to be trained from scratch, let's see if the Norfolk Cardiac Cath Lab has people who they have trained already as hospital corpsmen to be cath assistants, and we can bring them, when they're discharged, we can bring them here and hire them full time.
Do you know what year this was?
Probably, my guess is 62, 63.
So they started using firemen in the late 50s?
In the early 60s. It was not 50s, it was 60s. So Henry began to recruit people from the Norfolk Naval Hospital, and he recruited several, and they came here and were quite satisfactory. they did a great job. So I think this may have been the antecedent to Gene Stead's thinking about hospital corpsmen and medics of various types as recruiting for the for various jobs around the department. But it all mixed in at the same time was another experiment that Gene Stead was involved in, which was an interesting experiment with the nursing profession, because he felt that nurses could do more and should do more, and that he thought that nursing education was downright miserable because it was stereotyped, and it really didn't teach them about things that they were able to learn. So he struck up a friendship with a faculty member here at Duke in the nursing school who had like opinions. Her name was Thelma Ingalls. She was a PhD level nurse, and you've heard about her. And Thelma was very receptive to an expanded role for nursing. So she and Gene Stead put their heads together, and you probably have heard this from others. They started a master's level program for nurses, in which they, in effect, had a clinical internship with members of the... Well, Thelma Ingalls tested it first by becoming an intern herself with Gene Stead. As he made rounds on wards and so forth, she went with him. She spent a sabbatical year doing that. She felt that it would be a very good basis for a master's level nursing degree, and so they applied for a master's level training program for nurses. And they took in a class and put them through a full year of training, at the end of which the National League of Nursing declined to approve the program, saying that they didn't have proper faculty because all the faculty were not nurses, and it was one of their requirements that they had to be nurses. So though Thelma was fully occupied as a faculty member, she didn't count because there were physicians involved and they were not approved faculty. So the nursing profession turned it down, which infuriated Gene Stead, infuriated Thelma. And he was then out to find something to take the place of this failed or rejected program. So the PA program came very quickly after that program failed. And Gene Stead was a very unique individual. He made up his mind, and he had the resources, and he didn't ask questions, he just did, and he figured out how to justify it later. And so he began to talk this thing up, and as the head of the biggest and probably the most influential clinical department at Duke at the time. He was in a, and he had many minions under him that that did what he said. So he pulled together his department and said, "We're going to have a PA program," and he appointed several people to put together the basic framework of the program, which was not very well planned, to be honest, because I've learned a lot. And Gene Stead was an unusual educator. He was an educator of physicians and had been since the mid-40s, but his techniques were about as unformatted as you could get. He boasted that he had never in his entire career had a lecture in his department, and indeed he didn't. He didn't have courses in which you took a course in internal medicine or cardiology or anything of that sort. He said doctors learn by taking care of patients, and if you take care of patients as they come in the door, and you handle the problems which they bring to you, and you learn as much as you can about the problems they present, you will by necessity learn everything about medicine. You will not learn it in a specific order, but you will nevertheless learn it, and you'll learn it in proportion to its importance, because common things come in commonly. Rare things come in rarely, and but they still come in. And his chief teaching session, when he was at Grady and in Atlanta and when he came here, was a teaching exercise called Sunday School. Sunday School because it was on Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. And 10 o'clock on Sunday morning, every member of his department congregated in one lecture hall, and one resident was selected and this was planned months in advance. One resident was selected, and that resident had to prepare a discussion of the problem that was being discussed that day. And they at least gave the resident the option of choosing the topic. So the resident chose his own topic, and then another resident found a patient who presented with a problem, and that patient would always be brought down to the conference room, and the patient would be there for the presentation of his problem, and Dr. Stead and all the other faculty who were lined up on the front rows would ask the patient questions, and they would explain in very simple language that this conference was for the purpose of helping you by helping to solve, by discussing his problem, helping young physicians learn about his problem and what could be done. And we have all of these people on the front row here teaming up to put our attention on his problem. So that was his teaching technique. And that was, this was absolute hell for that resident. And they dreaded it for months. But they did it, and they learned a hell of a lot, and many of them became specialists in the topic that they took. For example, pulmonary disease problem would probably end up with that discussion being a specialist in pulmonary disease, because he became known in the resident group as the person who knows everything about that problem. He had spent months putting it together. Well, anyway, that was just Gene Stead's technique. And Gene Stead didn't think a lot about curricula and learning objectives. stuff like that that's very popular nowadays. So he said to Andy Wallace, who was his, one of his most junior faculty at that time, plan the curriculum for the PA program, find people to lecture, I'll find you a place to teach. And there weren't many of them, three, four. And so they tucked them in little corners. The concept at that point was ill-formed because we thought that they would be, at the time, we thought that they would be largely doing more or less technical tasks for a doctor in the office. They would learn how to do EKGs and how to do venipunctures and how to help with suturing, how to help with little things. But the concept that they would be the primary giver of care was not developed at all at that time. It was, people were fearful of that, and I guess we went to all kinds of lengths. I was a junior faculty member at the time, and I was one of those who taught the students how to take an electrocardiogram and read it, because that was my specialty. And we had a class to teach them how to do that. But the course was not, nobody sat and thought about what kinds of problems they were going to be presented with. And I'll come to that later, because we were called up on the carpet for that at a later point in the development of the program. Well, anyway, the PA program started. Gene Stead had convinced everybody in the medical school among his department chair compatriots that this was a good thing to do. And they recognized the problem. So the PA program was launched. And I guess it was 1963 or so. I may have been wrong in my previous estimate of when this was. It may have been the late 50s where all of this was happening with the firemen and so forth, because they started training PAs in 63. They finished in 65. I think that's right. I think they were in training when I became chair of my department in 1966. So they had to have started at least in 64, 65. Well, at any rate, the dates are...
In the literature.
In the literature. Well, we started, and the PA program marched along, and these people eventually... but the nurses were the only opposition, and that was because of early publicity, some of it a little overboard, because Look magazine ran a big article, and you know about that. Well, when the program began to graduate people, then the fat was in the fire, because there we were with these people, and there was no regulatory mechanism to receive them in practice. And we had an opinion from the state attorney general that there was nothing in the law that would keep a doctor from using a trained assistant to help him do things in the office. So that was the only authority we had for sending him out as hired people to work with doctors. But we were answering requests from people all over the state, because there was an acute shortage of primary care physicians, and the primary care physicians out there could not get help, and they were desperate. And so we sent some of the first ones out to work with doctors over the state, and we, at about that time, there was a movement countrywide in the mid-60s to form departments of family practice because of this acute shortage. There were no departments of family practice or general practice. In fact, family practice was a new word. It was general practice at that point. There was an American Academy of General Practice. But there was ferment around the country that this was a failing group. At that time, general practice was you took a year of medicine and a year of surgery, 6 months of pediatrics and 6 months of OB or something of that sort. It was totally ad hoc. And very few people did it. And that's one of the problems, because in internal medicine, people were going into cardiology and gastroenterology and pulmonology, and nobody was finishing as a general internist anymore. So we were training these people and putting them out as being an assistant to a family physician in various parts of the state, and we had no legal framework for doing so. About that time, we had a ferment in the medical school to start a department of general practice or family practice. This was opposed universally by the faculty at Duke. But we had two fairly prominent faculty members who were very dedicated to getting a department. And these two people had some influence. So the medical school formed a committee to study the problem. Instead of approving it, study it and do anything possible to avoid doing it.
So who were those two people, sir?
One was Dr. William DeMaria, DeMaria, a pediatrician. And he was influential because he was the pediatrician to almost every faculty member at Duke. He had taken care of all of their kids. And they trusted him and they loved him, and he could do no wrong. But except that one thing, he was wrong. And the other one was D.T. Smith, David T. Smith. David was a very senior member of the faculty. He was professor of medicine. He was the first chair of the Department of Bacteriology at Duke. So he was both a physician and a bacteriologist. And his expertise was in tuberculosis. And D.T. Smith was convinced that we needed a generalist physician. And so he and Bill DeMaria were lobbying for this department. They had some very potent support in the state, because the president of the American Academy of General Practitioners was a North Carolina physician from down in the middle of the state, and he was a very strong Duke supporter and referral doctor. He sent all his patients to Duke. And when his name was Amos Johnson, and Amos had hired a black young man to come with him as an informal physician assistant. And that's a part of the history as well. Amos Johnson was probably the first person to train his own PA. And he operated with him as his assistant for 20 years. Well, Amos Johnson was in favor of this departmental idea. Well, the dean at the time appointed a committee to study this thing. And the committee that was appointed came back and said, we don't need a department of family practice. We need a department of community health sciences, which takes sociology and organizational management techniques and computers. And let's think about ways of organizing medicine in such a way that doesn't have to be a family physician, but it can be PAs and computers and artificial intelligence, and maybe we can help the doctor do things in a different way. And I got a call, and 1966 from Gene Stead saying, I'd like to come talk to you, and which he did. And he said, he was on that committee. And he said, we formed this department. I think it has some potential, and I'd like you to head it. Why did he pick me? He certainly didn't pick me because I was interested in family medicine, or not interested in family medicine. I was a cardiologist doing cardiology at Duke. But I had one advantage, which nobody else in the place had, and that's that I had been very active in the North Carolina Medical Society and was very involved in the politics of state medical affairs and knew more doctors in the state than anybody else do. And a couple of years, and at a later point, I became president of that organization. But at that time, I was very involved on a whole bunch of state committees and had been involved in the state in the North Carolina Regional Medical Program and things of that sort. In other words, I knew doctors all over the damn state. And I knew them very well, and they knew me, and they respected me. And so I had an outreach that no one else in the medical school had, certainly not at the level of the department chairs and things of that sort. So Gene Stead said, do me a favor and become the first chair of this department. And so without really thinking about it that much, I did it. And found myself with the title of department chair with one room and one secretary and almost no budget. I would have negotiated better had I known the game. But nevertheless, I became chair of the department. And then this is while Gene Stead was still active as chair of the Department of Medicine. And we started developing a strategy for doing what I was supposed to do. And we formed a computer division. We formed a preventive medicine division and a bunch of stuff that would help us do this. But the PA program was not a part of it. But Gene Stead came to me a few months after that and said, look, I'm retiring at the end of 1966, and my replacement is going to be Dr. Weingarten, who had been chair at Pennsylvania, and Jim Weingarten is going to come here, and his interests are in research medicine, and he could not give a damn about the PA program. And if I leave it in his department, it's going to fail. So I would like you to take the PA program under the wing of this new department. It fits. This is a solution to the healthcare problem. So I became intimately involved with the PA program at that moment. Until that time, this had been Gene Stead's program and his department, and I was one of the teachers, but I had no primary responsibility for it. But at the moment Gene Stead retired and I took it over, then it was mine. And this was in late 1966. I think he retired in December of 1966. And so that's when I got intimately involved with it. So then it was my responsibility, and I had the job of filling in positions and organizing and so forth. And other people all over the country were beginning to do the same thing. And so there was beginning to be a nidus of programs, one at Bowman Gray, MedEx program in Washington, a few other programs, Aldous and Broadus. So we were beginning to be a critical mass of educational programs that were trying to train PAs, each in a different way at that time. Bowman Gray was quite influential at that time because Bowman Gray had a professional educator as their the head of that program. And this man knew all about educational techniques of a formalistic sort, teaching objectives, techniques of teaching, how you did it, how you organized it. And they pulled together a program that in retrospect was much more clearly delineated than ours, in that they started by going to a primary care office and saying, what do primary care doctors do? What are the reasons that patients come in their door? And let's take the first 100 entries on that list and let's see what skills we need to teach to equip somebody to be an assistant to a primary care doc. Very logical professional educator approach to the problem. Bowman Gray organized their curriculum that way and their teaching program that way. We did it the old way, which was find a surgeon, tell him that he has the responsibility of teaching these people surgery and let him do it. Find an internist, get him to do it, get an obstetrician to do it. In other words, very non-directive, very loose. It might come out exactly right, it might come out totally wrong. What Bowman Gray recognized, which we didn't at the time, is that the more you get doctors involved, the more they're going to teach these people what they are interested in and not what the primary care doc is interested in. And after 5 years, you're going to have an assistant to the tertiary specialist at Duke rather than a primary care specialist in East Overshoot. So I'm getting a little ahead, but I think it's important that we were, in effect, behind the educational eight ball at that point, and without really realizing how askew we were likely to get a little bit later. At the beginning, we did it fairly well, I think, because people tried to put themselves in the shoes of the primary care doc and train the PA that way. But as time went on, we began to get more and more people who were specialty inclined, and instead of getting a mature surgeon to do it who knew what it was like to be a surgeon in a small town, we tended to get junior faculty who were involved with their laboratory interests and who believed that everybody needs to know the same thing I do. All of this, we went on to help structure the PA as a legal entity within North Carolina. We put together conferences that by this time it's the early 70s. We are involved in trying to get laws passed that will allow the PA to practice with a physician supervisor, which we were successful in doing in North Carolina, and this became a model for many other states. We sort of regularized the training of PAs in what's become the Duke model, which is 15 months of didactic instruction, 9 months roughly of clinical instruction. But then we helped the AMA get an accrediting mechanism there so that we could assure that the PA programs that were training PAs were doing a good job. What we ended up with is representatives from the American College of Physicians, the American College of Family Practitioners that was there at the time, pediatrics and surgery, and some PAs and some representatives of programs, and this became the accrediting body that put a stamp of approval on the program. The problem we were facing at that time was, since there was no regulation, we had a program in Atlanta that I remember that wanted to train a PA in 6 weeks. and give them a certificate they can hang on the wall. I'm a PA. And we didn't think that was right, and it wasn't right. But this was a commercial venture. They would come. You could come to Atlanta for 6 weeks, you could get training, and you could go out with a certificate on your wall that says, I'm a PA. Well, we didn't think that was right, and we eventually prevailed because the accrediting mechanism made it necessary that you be accredited before you could say, I'm training PAs. Well, we got, the reason I'm going into detail is that we got caught in our own trap. We sailed through the accreditation procedure with no problem, but about 5 years later, the accrediting group came to Duke and said, look, your program is getting awfully specialized, and we don't think your program is going to be effective in training PAs out there in the real world.
About what year is this, sir?
I would say mid-70s. And so they said, you've got a year to turn your curriculum around. So we had to go borrow from Bowman Gray and learn how to do it, which we did. And the director of the program at that time was a physician named Mike Hamilton. And Mike did a superb job. He turned the PA program around in a year in a fashion that I would not have thought possible. He first of all went and learned what it was like to write good educational objectives and get the faculty organized. And he recruited Reg Carter, and Reg Carter was on the faculty at that time within the PA program, and he recruited other people from medicine and surgery who were chosen not because they were the hottest young comer, but because they were mature, seasoned people who would follow an outline and knew why the outline was there and were there to be helpful and to teach them what they needed to know. There's a constant danger of making that mistake over and over and over again. And we have to continually remind ourselves that we are training people to do a job, and we're not training them to be cardiologists or neuroendocrinologists. We're training them to be assistants to the primary care physician, principally. That doesn't mean they can't be assistant to the neurophysiologist, but they got to learn that later. We're not going to teach them. Well, anyway, that's how we, and the program, I think, matured and became much, much better with under Mike's rearrangement and learning to be a better teacher. And I think it's been going strong ever since. Now, back to your original question.
Real quick, was Dr. Hamilton under you, or had he taken up?
Yeah, he was the head of the PA division in my department.
Okay.
And we ended up with a department that had five divisions. We had a PA division under Mike Hamilton.
Right.
We had an occupational medicine division. We had a family medicine division. We eventually got family medicine because it was obvious we couldn't solve this problem without getting a generalist physician out there. And we had to fight like hell to get that. We had a computer division. And let's see, we had another one which was an oddity, but it was the division that was supposed to pay all our bills, and that was the Diet and Fitness Center. We had a program, it's still going, and it's still profitable. It brings people from all over the country to Durham and teaches them to lose weight. And it's a very good program. It's a residence program. They come here and stay a month. They usually lose about 30 pounds. And they go home educated as to how they can maintain their weight loss. Now, many of them don't maintain it, but they learn how. It brings them in. We bought an old Y building in the middle of town, and we still have it. And we renovated it. We had a full basketball court. We had a full Olympic-sized pool. And we've still got it. And they lived across the street, and they came in, and we had a teaching kitchen, and we had psychologists and physiologists and exercise therapists, and taught, and we would take them to town and show them how to shop in a grocery store and watch them fix a meal. And we had a teaching kitchen. Still do it.
I bet.
And it's made a great deal of money. It's paid off its debt. But anyway, that was the 5th Division. It was an interesting department. And and the PA program has been really, a superb program ever since. It still is. And it's going strong. And the department's going strong. I left the department in 1985 as chairman. Stayed on for another 5 years as a geriatrician and did all kinds of things, geriatrics, house calls, things of that sort. Ran several nursing homes using PAs and nurse practitioners very heavily. And then I retired in 1990. So I've been retired from the department and function since, teaching functions since 1990, except that I still go over and do some lectures with the PA program every year.
On what do you lecture?
The history of the PA program, sort of, and I also talk about how to stay out of. I have a lecture on medical organizations and how they get themselves into trouble. And I believe that the American Medical Association is in deep, deep shit. And the way it's gotten in there is a predictable and almost stereotyped mechanism. And what happens is that you hire people and you expect them to be good administrators, and they eventually take over the whole function, and they eventually eliminate the people that they represent, and they become the organization. The organization becomes the administrators rather than the membership. So I teach our people, avoid that like a plague, because it will kill you, and just as it killed AMA, I think. And the PAs have thus far seemed to avoid it. They have a pretty membership-driven organization still. I don't know how long it'll last, because it's an almost inevitable evolution that you hire good people, they become better, they demand more attention and more money, and the membership gets lax, gets not involved, and the average person in the AMA doesn't work for the AMA, they just belong, and they expect the AMA to do it all, and that's not the way it ought to be. Well, anyway, that's another aside, but and I do some workshops and things like that. You know, nothing very important. But
teaching is always important.
Yeah. Well, back to the involvement with the military. That we were involved with the military from the beginning, and we had contracts with the Coast Guard. And we may have had contracts with others too. I don't remember how many, but I know the Coast Guard was involved. And every year we take a certain number of people from the Coast Guard, and they would be the Coast Guard member. They picked them. But they came there, and they were treated just like anybody else, and they went through and they became PAs in the Coast Guard.
What year did that start, sir, roughly?
This started roughly, I would guess, in the late 60s. In the first several classes, we had a Coast Guard member, and they went back and became active Coast Guard members. And I think we by that time, Mike was making all these arrangements, and I was one step removed. So this is why I don't know as much as Mike would know, or Bob Howard. The first head of the division, by the way, was a guy named Bob Howard. And Bob Howard is dead now. He was a family physician who really came here and requested a job because he had heard about the PA program. And he says, I believe in it, and I think I can be helpful. And indeed he was. How are you? He was excellent. He was a very unique individual. He was he ran full tilt, and he left here after many years and became the head of the family medicine division at Mercer. And he got into trouble, deep trouble at Mercer, in that he had some marital problems and he got into drugs, and he went downhill fast and he ended up dying in the federal pen.
That is downhill.
He died of cancer of the lung. But Bob was superb when he was here, and he would work like a dog, and he worked with the AMA and all of its mechanism for getting the accreditation mechanism started and all of that. And then Mike Hamilton came, then Reg Carter, and you know it from there. We were involved with we were involved as consultants with the service many times. Bob Howard was involved, and this is what made me think of him, because he would go visit the I think it was in San Antonio that the Army had its training programs, and so we became consultants to the when the armed forces began to train their own. But we also took them as our call from other branches of the service, and we didn't treat them any different from anybody else. They went through just exactly like everybody else did, and nobody knew that they were Coast Guard or Air Force or Navy or whatever. We didn't coddle them or treat them in any different fashion. But and I cannot tell you how many of them we took, or what their treatment and what became of them, or anything of that sort. I know that some did go ahead to become officers, and many of our members have joined the armed forces and have done a damn good job. But I can't tell you which of those were Army or Navy before they came in, because I don't know. It wouldn't have made any difference. I've gotten you off on all kinds of tangents, but I don't know whether I've answered your questions or not.
Yes, to the most part. I guess one question is, how much of the initial curriculum did come from either the school in San Antonio or I had this interview with Mr. Moe.
Yeah.
And he was saying he and Eugene Stead went down to Fort Bragg and looked at their program.
Yeah.
So I was wondering how much of the initial curriculum came.
Well, yeah, they tried to. I think Moe and Stead went down and looked at how they trained corpsmen more than what their curriculum, because at that time when they went down, I don't think they had a formal PA program. It was just training of corpsmen. So they did go down and look at that so that they would know what they were getting when they got these people. But I don't think it influenced the early curriculum very much. Jim Moe, you've interviewed somebody who I think was very important back there.
I'll interview him on Thursday, sir. I haven't talked to him yet.
Oh, you haven't yet?
Yes, sir. Thursday.
Well, Jim was very influential. He was Gene Stead's right arm. He was his administrator. And Jim Mobile was assigned the duty of finding a spot for all these people, getting all of the administrative details in, lined up. A great guy. And Gene Stead depended on him, and he depended on Gene Stead. They worked as a really wonderful team, and I'm glad you're talking to him.
I think it'll be a valuable conversation.
I think it will.
Then one other thing that was mentioned in one of the Fort Bragg interviews anyway was that Dr. Stead tried to hire some people from the military who were training corpsmen to come up to Duke. I was wondering if you knew anything about
it. I didn't know that.
I only have one source that says that.
I didn't know that. Now, he may have been trying to recruit them into the program, and I suspect he was. Why don't you come up to Duke and we'll put you through the program?
Make an officer out of you.
Make an officer out of it. I suspect he did that. But as far as I know, he didn't try to recruit any teachers.
Okay.
Because he really had all he could use with his department. Well, that's interesting, but it may not be true.
Right. I was hoping to corroborate it somewhere, yeah. Somewhere up here. And then, I guess more generally, how do you see the PA today as the initial vision in 1965?
Very different. Well,
different in a positive way? Or?
Very positive. I think none of us at that point would have envisioned a PA going out and literally taking over a clinic and running it, which many of them are doing now, and doing this removed many miles from their supervising physicians. That would have been, many people would have voted it down had they realized that this was going to be the outcome. I think that's great, and I think that the PA is probably going to be the primary care provider of the future, countrywide, because I think doctors have become too expensive, they've become too overtrained, they've become too enamored of making a lot of money, and I don't think it's to anybody's advantage to push more doctors of that sort when you can push PAs, and I think nurse practitioners are evolving in the same direction. But unfortunately, the nurse practitioner who started very close to the PA and practical training is going to be more and more nurse training.
Anything to drink?
Big boy.
Anything to drink?
Not a thing. Thank you.
You are.
I think they are becoming more and more isolated from the medical profession by their own choice, by their leader's choice, not the individual nurse practitioners. In fact, they come out. But this is one problem that I'm seeing in other venues. PAs and nurse practitioners are going out, and people are forgetting one important fact that PAs always left here with at the beginning, and that's that the PA is an unfinished product. The PA has been trained to appreciate and understand many things, but the PA is not a practically trained assistant to anybody at that minute that they leave here. They are assumed to be employed by a physician who is going to be aware of that fact and is going to be willing to train them in the knowledge and skills that he or she has, and to watch them and to be a mentor in their further development. And we see over and over again a doctor who will hire a PA from right out of school at Duke and say, you're in charge of this clinic, and I'm going to be over here 20 miles away. If you have any questions, call me. Now, that is the doctor's fault. It's the PA's fault, too, for taking a job like that and thinking that they can handle it without having some bobbles along the way. But that understanding that the PA and the nurse practitioner, too, are unfinished products as they emerge from their training program. Now, they become very good after they've been seasoned by good, solid practitioners who are their trainers and their further mentors. But that's my only fear. I think trained in the proper way by a mentor, by first one or two mentors who can teach them caution and teach them practical knowledge and teach them to be honest and say, I don't know, I need to find out, and how to find out, or how to refer. If we can avoid that mistake, then I think the PA and the nurse practitioner can be a solid basis for a primary care system that will be to everybody's advantage.
So if PAs take over the primary care, do you think in the future it would be possible for veteran PAs to be able to train the novices, or will they still have to go to an MD for their first few years?
I think they could train them, and they largely do now. Many doctors turn their new PA over to their old PA to train. Now that requires constant feedback. Is it breaking down? And that's another potential mistake that we can make, is to forget that feedback, that if we have PAs training PAs, that we have got to then make sure that those PAs understand the connection with medicine, because the work that a PA does today and a practice has evolved from the medical practice of 5 years ago or 10 years ago at some cutting edge level somewhere. Techniques of practice evolve and change, and it was said at one point that the half-life of everything you ended medical school with is about 5 years, and every 5 years you wash out half of what you've learned. It's been replaced by something else, so you've got to constantly go back and replenish yourself at the well. Well, if you don't replenish yourself at the medical well, then you're going to be in bad shape. And if the teacher of that PA is nothing but a teacher of that PA and doesn't himself replenish at the medical well, he's going to be 50% as good in 5 years as he was at the beginning, 25% as good in 10 years, 12.5%, and so forth. And in time, he's going to wash out and be no good at all. So that connection has got to be made. You can't divorce yourself from the medical profession. You've got to be a part of it. Now, I'm very proud of something that I had a responsibility for in North Carolina, in that I introduced a measure in our state medical society saying they're going to accept PAs as members of the medical society, and they are members of the medical society now, and doctors accept them as such. We tried to do the same thing for nurse practitioners and were turned down.
Is that pretty common among state medical society?
No. There are several now that do it, but it's not real common. We're not the only ones now, but we were the first one.
What year was that, sir?
Oh, I don't remember. It's probably about 10 years ago. That's my guess.
Sure.
It's been a long time. But we tried to do it with nurse practitioners, but that was defeated by our House of Delegates of the Medical Society. They didn't want to bring nurses in. The antipathy is fairly is on both sides. And there's a great deal of distrust, which I think is doing nobody any good. Well, anything else I can do you?
Is there anything else you wanted to add about the story, sir?
I don't think of anything. Well, if you think of anything, give me a call.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.